Hello and welcome to The Wire Weekly, with the best stories of the week from the daily episodes of The Wire. I'm Amina Shakur, coming to you from Sin in Melbourne, Victoria. Thanks for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network. And today on the show,
it was like watching the entire ecosystem wash onto the beach with no explanation. It was just happening right in front of our eyes.
And today on The Wire Weekly, South Australia algal bloom spreads, raising transparency concerns.
For organisations to collect data on neurodiversity in the work, it's really simple. You can't improve what you don't measure. So what we're asking for organisations to do is to actually just understand neurodiversity.
New Australian Guide, helping support neurodivergent employees at work. And later today,
Australia is the only developed Western democracy without a federal human rights framework. The ACT, Victoria and Queensland have all addressed this by enacting their own Human Rights Act.
A push has been made to the New South Wales Parliament calling on a public inquiry into a human rights bill. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. As the state advances towards the next term of government, South Australia remains in the grips of a harmful algal bloom, an issue that's plagued South Australia's marine environment and coastal communities for the last 12 months. The bloom has spread 20,000 kilometres since its emergence in March 2025. Seeing the far reach of environmental, personal, health and economic impact. Now a year from the first report of South Australia's harmful algae, an ABC Four Corners investigation alleges state governments took months to update health advisors, raising questions around transparency. The Wire's Emma Watsky with the story.
That means we haven't sold an oyster for now 3 weeks. And so that has probably cost my business, which is just my wife and I, probably $10,000 in the last couple of weeks.
It's heartbreaking. There were days that we walked the beaches and it was death every single step. It was like watching the entire ecosystem wash onto the beach with no explanation. It was just happening right in front of our eyes at the beaches where I learned to swim and learned to snorkel. And then it just continued to spread throughout the peninsula and Kangaroo Island.
South Australian ecologist Dr. Faith Coleman was one of the leading scientific voices during the algal bloom. We spoke with Dr. Coleman back in July, where she dismissed suggestions an algal bloom like this had never happened anywhere before.
The Northern Hemisphere's kicked in as well, and so I have clients and colleagues who are experiencing similar blooms. So there's New Zealand's got an issue at the moment. There's an issue in West Australia. There's a bloom of something else in Albania. Spain's looking not so good. And there is at least 30 or 40 other major blooms.
Dr. Coleman resigned from her positions on government boards amid allegations of political interference. The ecologist is now running alongside Tammy Franks as an independent candidate for the state's upper house. Ms. Franks has been particularly critical of how the SA government has managed the algal bloom so far, including a recent SA government preliminary report that has avoided public scrutiny.
The new Minister for Environment and Water rushed out saying that she had a report that confirmed that the government had been vindicated about the causes of the algal bloom. That report, of course, we still haven't been told who authored it. We still haven't been told what's in it.
Now, a year on from the first report of SA's harmful algae, an ABC Four Corners investigation alleges state government took months to update health advice, raising questions around transparency.
However, we've known right from the start of this algal bloom, the very first surfers and indeed the fishers were getting rashes on their skins, had stinging eyes, and as we saw on Four Corners last night, had symptoms such as gastro. If you live on the coastal community, you are well aware of these symptoms. They have continued through the algal bloom and aren't just when you go in the water, and yet they are not being proactively monitored by SA Health or any government agencies here in South Australia.
While SA Deputy Premier Kaya Ma says he hadn't seen the ABC reporting at the time of the interview, he defended the government's track record.
It's not something we'd seen in Australia before. We'd seen it in places like California and Florida to have different natured but different brevetoxins, but it's not something we'd seen here before. We followed pretty closely the advice of the scientists as to what we should do, but it was exceptionally unpredictable. You know, we've committed for the summer plan more than $100 million, of which half of it's already gone out the door to help people, help businesses, help particularly the fishing industry. There's been First Nations input in relation to that. I was seeing particularly Narunga and Nurrungeri contribute and put forward ideas. When you're dealing with something that hasn't happened before, you have to rely on the advice you're getting, and that's what we did.
That obviously was somewhat unpredictable, but with reference to the segment on Four Corners, I understand that the waters tested positive for brevetoxin back in May 2025, but the health advice didn't actually change until September last year.
As I said, as a government, it's not my portfolio area, but I know as a cabinet, we relied on the advice we're getting. That's the scientific advice from, particularly from SARDI, and also the health advice we're getting from the public health part of the health department.
Deputy Leader of the Opposition in South Australia, Josh Teague, spruiked Liberals' management of the COVID crisis, in contrast to Labor's approach to the algae bloom.
What was very obviously a growing crisis all the way through last year, and yet for so long, month after month after month, we had a government telling us that it's not toxic, minimising the situation.
Rebecca Sharkey, a federal independent, has seen the state government's response to the algae bloom play out across her electorate.
It really does move from day to day, season to season. We've seen some parts of Mayo more impacted than others. Some days it can be beautiful, the other days it can, sweep in on the tides and the currents.
While there has been positive action from state government, she says the issue has been brushed off by Labor.
The current state government is very good at crafting the narrative of what's discussed in the papers. They have a very big majority. They're potentially going to increase that majority this state election. That's certainly what some of the polling showing. To a degree, we talk about what the state government wants to talk about.
That was The Wire's Emma Watsky with the story. A new guide to help workplaces better support neurodivergent employees has been launched. Diversity Council Australia and MAIS have released Neurodiversity Data at Work, a guide to help organisations safely collect data about neurodiversity in the workplace. The aim is to help employees understand experiences of neurodivergent staff and improve workplace inclusion. I spoke with MAIS CCO Alexandra Lazarus-Priestley about the new guide.
The guide primarily exists because there's a significant gap between how organisations understand and report on and then act on neurodivergence within the workplace. So research estimates that somewhere between 15 and 20% of the population are neurodivergent, and that's quite low estimation. But very few organisations are actively collecting data on this, specifically in Australia. So without that data, neuroinclusion tends to just sort of stay at the level of good intention rather than informed action. Part of the reason that gap exists is that organisational narrative has often been about access and adjustments based on diagnostic criteria. So a medical model of disability, which then something needs to be clinically verified before it's taken seriously. And we very much move away from clinical diagnosis or descriptions of diagnosis within the guide itself. It's about understanding that diagnosis is not accessible to many people within the community. Diagnosis pathways are uneven, expensive, and historically biased towards particular demographics.
Why is it important for organisations to collect data on neurodiversity in workplaces?
So if we take neurodiversity being the overarching paradigm, so it's actually to say that there are all different types of brains and nervous systems within the population, and every version of that is right and normal. So that when we're talking about neurodiversity, that's what we're talking about. But for organizations to collect data on neurodiversity in the work, it's really simple. You can't improve what you don't measure. So what we're asking for organizations to do is to actually just understand neurodiversity, neurodivergent, and to find out in the very first instance around proportion, population and proportion of population. So you actually understand the makeup of your work.
The guide encourages organisations to collect data voluntarily. Why is that important?
It's really important for neurodiversity data to be collected both voluntarily and anonymously. And the reason goes far deeper than just respecting personal choice, which is also really, really important. But the backdrop to any data collection question is the history of experience neurodivergent people bring to it. Many have had personal information used against them in the past. It's about trust. It's about action. They may have had negative experiences themselves or have seen colleagues treated differently after becoming visible. And because that context is always present, it has to be voluntary. The minute you were to make that kind of data collection mandatory, it doesn't just ignore the context, it actively confirms the fear that the organization is seeing it as something to be tracked rather than to be understood.
How can workplace data better create more inclusive environments for neurodivergent people?
The most direct thing that the data does is make patterns visible that otherwise would be explained away individually. So we advocate for starting with representation data, you know, simply understanding whether neurodivergent people are present in your workforce and to what proportion. It's an achievable, immediately useful baseline that tells an organization really whether you have a visibility problem before you try to work on anything more complex. Critically, it also starts to build trust and track record that makes deeper collection, data collection possible. So what we're really talking about in terms of workforce data is by understanding from a representation perspective, and then if you do have the space, an organization does have the opportunity to ask the second question, which is around neurotype or diagnosis, is that then that starts to layer in or gives you the opportunity to start layering in experience data, which is around combining neurodiversity data with engagement survey responses, retention figures, career progression.
That was AMAZE CCO Alexandra Lazarus Priestley speaking with The Wire. An alliance of 120 human rights organisations is pushing the New South Wales Parliament to call on public inquiry into Human Rights Bill. Last year, Green State MP Jenny Leung introduced a private members bill to protect human rights in the state. The bill will lapse next week if not discussed. Organisations are calling for a wider consultation on the matter. The Wire's Eduardo Jordan spoke to President of Australian Lawyers for Human Rights, Kerry West, about the consequences of not having a bill in the state.
So Stellar PV is an Australian company and we're building a solar wafer manufacturing facility near Townsville. So the easiest way to picture it is to think about a solar panel. So if you look at a solar panel on top of a rooftop or on, you know, beside the road, you'll see these black squares or blue, dark blue squares that are on that solar panel. And those squares are tiles or cells, and each of those starts with a solar wafer. And that's what we're going to make at Stellar PV is the solar wafers. So rather than building the end solar panel, we're making one of the key ingredients that goes inside it. And at the moment, the solar supply chain, the global supply chain for these wafers is extremely concentrated. Most of it's made by China. So projects like ours will help diversify the supply chain as solar continues to grow around the world.
Now, as you mentioned, you produce wafers for solar panels. What's the process like, what sort of process do you follow to create these wafers?
A solar wafer actually starts a little bit further upstream, and we mine the rock quartz. So rock quartz is a very pure white crystal. We mine it about halfway between Cairns and Townsville, and then it'll come into Townsville and it'll hopefully get turned into polysilicon. So there's a couple of other projects that are looking at metallurgical silicon and polysilicon in the area. We take that polysilicon. Now, at this point, it's a shiny black rock, and we put it into a furnace. And so the furnace is heated to 1500 degrees Celsius so that it melts into this sort of molten, red-hot, glowing liquid silicon. And we dip a seed crystal into that silicon and we draw it up. It takes a couple of days to make one of these, what we call an ingot, but it's a big black shiny rod of very, very pure silicon. And we grow it over a couple of days by pulling it up out of that molten liquid. We then take those silicon ingots and we have to wafer them into paper thin slices, which we call a wafer. And we use thousands of kilometers of diamond wire. It's very, very thin diamond wire. And it looks a little bit like a bread slicing machine. So if you think about the white bread at the bakery, but it's very, very fine. And we've sliced that silicon ingot into thousands of individual wafers. And they're about a piece of paper thick and they're about 20 centimeters square. So that's what we do within our factory is the slicing, the ingot growing and the slicing.
Oh, wow, that's very, very interesting. The federal government has granted a project to Stellar PV with investment. What does it mean for Stellar PV?
So we're funded by the Australian Renewable Energy Agency, ARENA. So they've given us some money to help us get our engineering and our planning across the line. But we're also federally sponsored through the major projects piece. So that's going to help us to push forward more quickly with our project and get the approvals more quickly. We still need to go through all of the normal procedures. We still do all of our environmental and community engagement in the process, but it allows us to get the project off the ground much more quickly than we would otherwise do.
I understand the factory or the headquarters will be located in Townsville. How will this benefit workers in the area and the local economy there?
The factory will create hundreds of jobs during construction, and then there'll be more than 300 jobs during operation. And those type of jobs will be engineers, technicians, advanced manufacturing specialists, and operational staff. We'll be also working with the local universities and the TAFE to train people for those roles. And for Townsville, it's about building that sort of next generation of manufacturing industry in the region. And we'll be bringing, obviously, with that investment, creating skilled jobs and supporting the local businesses in the area.
Kerry West from the Australian Lawyers for Human Rights there, speaking with The Wire's Eduardo Jordan. The federal government has approved a major renewable energy project in Townsville aimed at supporting Australia's shift away from fossil fuels. Stellar PV plans to manufacture silicon solar wafers for panels at scale to meet growing domestic demand, with the project expected to create more than 300 full-time jobs. Construction of the plant is set to begin within the next 12 months. The Wire's Eduardo Jordan spoke with CEO of Stellar PV, Louise Hurl, for more.
Well, Human Rights Act for New South Wales is an alliance of more than 120 legal and community organisations, faith bodies and trade unions. We are all united behind the idea that New South Wales should engage in a comprehensive community consultation or an inquiry into a Human Rights Act for New South Wales. We're all concerned that New South Wales has fallen seriously behind other states and territories, and indeed every other comparable democracy, when it comes to protecting people's human rights. Australia is the only developed Western democracy without a federal human rights framework. The ACT, Victoria and Queensland have all addressed this by enacting their own Human Rights Act, but New South Wales hasn't.
Now, could you please tell us a little bit more about the proposal into the human rights legislation in New South Wales?
Well, there's currently a private members bill before the parliament that proposes a model that's very similar to the ones that have been operating successfully for decades in the ACT, Victoria, and most recently in Queensland. This model would deliver a number of significant reforms. It would create a piece of legislation that legally articulate people's rights based on Australia's international legal obligations under treaties like the International Covenant of Civil and Political Rights and the International Covenant on Economic, Social and cultural rights. So things like the right to freedom of assembly, the right to education, the right to the healthcare, the right to housing. A second significant thing that the bill would do would require Parliament to consider these rights every time that it develops new laws, amends existing laws, or develops new policies. So the Parliament, government introducing the bill, or if it's another member of the Parliament, would have to state whether the law is compatible or incompatible with the rights that are protected in the Human Rights Act. The key thing that it would deliver is that New South Wales public authorities would have to consider people's human rights whenever they make decisions about them while they're delivering services to them. So that would mean that people's human rights have to be considered when, for example, the Department of Education makes a decision about their child's education, when a decision is made by aged care service provider, or when a decision is made in relation to access for housing for somebody who's experiencing domestic violence.
One of the reasons the Alliance, have called today is to make a public inquiry into this bill because it lapses next week. What are some of the reasons you're asking for this public inquiry?
We are asking for a public inquiry because the New South Wales Labor platform promises one. The government took to the last election a promise to establish a community consultation into legislation to better protect the human rights of New South Wales residents. So we're calling on the Parliament to deliver on that promise, on the Minns government to establish a community consultation. And this bill offers a really fantastic opportunity to do that through referral of the bill to a parliamentary inquiry. We're calling for an inquiry because it's really important that New South Wales do the work to identify gaps in existing rights protections, learn from other jurisdictions that have had human rights acts for decades, and then identify and design a nation-leading human rights act. We also are really committed to the principle that everyone in the New South Wales community should be consulted on a human rights act.
And speaking about vulnerable members of the community, what population sectors are the most disadvantaged if this act doesn't go ahead?
Well, look, everyone in New South Wales will benefit from the legal protection of their human rights, whether it's through helping to secure their child's right to education or protecting people's right to housing. Everyone benefits from human rights protections, and that has definitely been the experience in the states that have human rights acts already. But obviously, it's the people who often fall through the cracks who will, for whom reform would be really transformative. So First Nations communities would be able to benefit through having their human rights considered in decisions about things like imprisonment, over-incarceration, housing, access to healthcare services in regional and remote areas. Obviously, also people from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds, people at risk of homelessness.
That was CEO of Stella PV, Louise Hurl, speaking to The Wire's Eduardo Jordan. Last week, students across Australia sat their NAPLAN tests, introduced in 2008, to assess skills like reading, writing, and numeracy. But concerns have emerged with some private and selective schools reportedly using NAPLAN results in enrolment decisions. Head of NAPLAN, Stephen Neal, has called this horrendous and a misuse of assessment. The Wire's Thomas Curtis spoke with education expert Stephen Lewis from the Australian Catholic University about concerns around fairness.
NAPLAN was introduced in 2008 and was originally designed as a low-stakes way to measure system-level performance across the different states and territories of Australia. So even though Australia has education at the state and territory level as an authority, we really wanted to be able to have that comparison across the different states at an Australian national level. So it's a census test, which means that all students in years 3, 5, 7 and 9 complete the test. And we're looking at measuring them across literacy and numeracy. So in literacy, it's reading, writing, conventions of language, which includes spelling, grammar and punctuation, and then numeracy as well. And we assign sort of performance, if you like, on the basis of how many students are performing at the different proficiency levels of NAPLAN. So what it really lets us do is see how the different states and territories are going, but also how different student populations are performing in literacy and numeracy. So, you know, do students, for instance, in the regions and rural areas, do they perform better or worse than their city counterparts? Students for whom language is a, you know, additional language or who might have learning difficulties, how well are they comparing against students without those difficulties? So really lets us take the temperature of student learning, but in a really low stakes way, and that low stakes is very important.
I understand that NAPLAN is being used by schools now as an entrance test to screen or select students in order to get into a school. In your opinion, how widespread is this?
I think there's a fair bit of both anecdotal but also research evidence that suggests it's more common than we would like. I couldn't say how many, you know, selective schools or private schools across the country are doing that as a percentage, but certainly now we've been seeing, since NAPLAN has been sort of more publicised and the performance of schools has been publicised via the My School website in 2010, it's increasingly taking on a more high-stakes flavour. What we're seeing is often private schools and government selective school principals asking for students' NAPLAN result as part of that intake. So it's not being used as in the way in which it was originally intended, but it's now being used in this more high-stakes way. And the research shows that that's very, very damaging and unfair to the students and the teachers and the families of students who are, you know, in completing these tests. What we really want to be sure ensuring is students see this test as low stakes. It's not something they should be anxious about, and it's not something that's going to determine their future pathways in terms of, you know, representing their success in school or their life trajectory after school. But unfortunately, if we are using it in this high stakes way to allow private schools and selective schools to use it basically as a proxy entrance exam, that really is quite a significant perversion of the original intent of NAPLAN. And I think we need to call it out for the risk and danger that it is.
Why do you think schools are relying on NAPLAN scores as a way to make it an entrance test for students getting into schools?
Look, it's a really good question, and I'd hate to speak for the individual school principals who might be taking this practice, but from the research and from the work that I've done on NAPLAN over the last 12 or so years, what I'd really sort of emphasise is that when we have a standardised measure of student learning or student performance such as NAPLAN, increasingly we can see the risk that it's used in unintended ways. So because every student does NAPLAN, it does provide that really common yardstick, if you like, for how students' learning is being measured.
That was Associate Professor of Education Policy Stephen Lewis from the Australian Catholic University speaking to The Wire's Thomas Kudis. And that's the end of today's show. Thanks so much for your company wherever you are in Australia. The Wire Weekly is a collaboration between community radio stations SYN in Melbourne, 2SER in Sydney, Radio 4EB in Brisbane, and contributors from all across the country, with the great support from the Walkley Foundation and Community Radio Network. We'll see you next time with the stories making headlines across your community and Indigenous radio. At the same time on your local station. Check out all of this week's stories at our website, thewire.org.au. And follow us on social media. Just search for The Wire Radio, all one word, on X or on Facebook and Instagram at The Wire, independent current affairs on radio around Australia. The Wire Weekly acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations, where the program has been produced. And we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders past, present and emerging. Today, The Wire Weekly is brought to you by SYN in Melbourne, Victoria. I'm Amina Shakur. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you next time with many more stories on The Wire Weekly.